Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keen On, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers.
Hello, everybody. A few days ago, I saw an interesting movie on Netflix, of course, The Greatest Night in Pop, about a January night in 1985, when some of the greatest musicians of that age, including Diana Ross, Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, got together to sing a song, We Are the World, in direct response to back then in 1985, the famine in Ethiopia, of course, sparked by some of the work Bob Geldof was doing in the UK. For musicians to support suffering around the world. 50 years, though, of course, before 1985, in the mid-1930s, the United States was in the midst of the Great Depression. And rather than Ethiopia, the human suffering was next door, particularly in the American countryside. The Great Depression hit the farming communities of the Midwest with particular violence. Many farmers lost their homes, huge amount of suffering, starvation. Interestingly enough, there's a new book out about music as a way of, I don't know quite know how to put it, a music to address that great crisis in humanity in the mid-1930s. The book is called A Chance to Harmonize, How FDR's Hidden Music Unit Sought to Save America from the Great Depression, One Song at a Time. It's written by a Berkeley-based musicologist, Cheryl Kaskowitz, who is joining us from Berkeley now. She lives just up the road from where I used to live in Berkeley. Cheryl, can one compare the terrible violence of the famine in Ethiopia in 1985 with what was happening in America in the 1930s, do you think?
It's so fascinating that you brought in that lens, because I hadn't made that connection before. But certainly, if you think about, the level of suffering, it's hard to compare suffering and trauma, but there was, I think that it's hard for people to remember or to understand, since most of us don't remember, the level of suffering that was wrought by the Great Depression. People lost their homes, lost their jobs. Some people had to leave the land where they were because of dust storms, things like that, So I actually think it's a really interesting way in to think about it.
Yeah, and it's rather crass to compare human tragedy and suffering. I don't mean to suggest that we can quantify them, but similar kinds of catastrophes and similar ways in which music was used to address that. Of course, when it came to The Greatest Night in Pop, the We Are the World, it was premised on the making of a single, which was then sold, and the money was used to support relief efforts in Ethiopia. What you write about, though, in A Chance to Harmonize is rather different. Song, or the role of local song, is more central. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. The music itself was used to help build community, boost morale, give people hope, and pride in themselves and in their communities. So in that way, it was more direct, right? It wasn't fundraising, and it was being done by the US government, by the New Deal.
So why don't you get into it? Of course, we've done many shows on FDR and the New Deal. Why was what you're describing in A Chance to Harmonize, the Hidden New Deal program that used folk music to try to change America, why is it so symbolic of FDR and the New Deal?
Oh, That's a great question. What I often find is that people equate the WPA with the New Deal. And that was a focus on jobs and getting people back to work. And that was very important. This came out of an effort to offer relief. So it came out of the Resettlement Administration, which was brief. It lasted 2 years. Then it became part of the Farm Security Administration. It was renamed. And part of that was because it was probably one of the more radical agencies and initiatives of the New Deal in terms of an attempt to remake American ideology, I would say. And that is actually made very explicit in the reports about what the music unit in specifically was doing to try to build community on these government homesteads that were built by the Resettlement Administration. In rural areas, they were meant for people. They were called stranded populations. And so that was farmers whose land had failed, literally could not farm anymore. The government would buy that back and turn it back into forest or, a park situation. Then you have miners and other industrial workers where the mill had closed, the mine had closed. There was no other way to make a living where they were. And urban unemployed who were, in a way, stranded in the cities where they lived because there was no opportunities for work. And so it was this idea of getting people off of relief or the dole and in this very dramatic way, and that was framed at the time as an experiment, building new homestead communities in these rural areas, having people come in and create something from scratch. And the idea was that it was supposed to be based on the idea of cooperation. And it was run by someone who's been a bit lost to history with a fantastic name, Rexford Guy Tugwell.
Yeah, and he was a very good looking fellow, wasn't he? At least.
Yes. And
he looked like a movie star, but.
Right. That's exactly what I thought when I saw that picture. And the press.
He was an economics professor at Columbia who somehow got plucked out of academia to run the Resettlement Administration by FDR.
Yes. Yeah. So he was part of the Brain Trust who FDR assembled as advisors. So yeah, an economics professor, very progressive in his views. He called himself, a collectivist or a communalist. He believed that cooperation, cooperative farming, cooperative industries was kind of the solution to getting out of the Great Depression. And yes, as you can imagine, he became basically the whipping boy for the progressive flank of the New Deal.
Yeah, I'm guessing conservatives, Cheryl, if they have the audacity to watch my show, will be thinking, oh my God, this is Stalinism, or certainly
Soviet-style
progressivism in America, the idea of resettlement, new communities. Was there that element to it in a good or even perhaps a bad way?
Oh, he was called Rex the Red. Anything he did, he actually, the first thing that he tried to do was put forward the food and drug bill, because before this time, there hadn't really been regulations around what people could say about food and drugs when they were advertised. And nobody else wanted to touch it because it was so, there was so much opposition, you know, from conservatives.
And this was Rex Redd running the, a lot of ours here, the Resettlement Administration. He ran it. And,
that's right.
Yeah. So how big was this administration? How much money and resource did FDR give it?
Oh, it was huge. I think it was 46. I often confuse million and billion at this point because.
Well, I hope it would be billion.
But huge for its time. It had, you know, over 10,000 employees. And what it was a reorganization of a lot of different kinds of initiatives. And it was named after the resettlement division. There were two. There was actually a suburban and a rural resettlement. My focus is on rural. People should know about suburban because that's where like Greenbelt, Maryland came from, just as an aside. So Rex the Red, as they called him, was given control to try this experiment. What happens if we set up these communities in these rural areas, you know, and provide for people? You know, it also came out of Eleanor Roosevelt was very much involved in these homesteads.
Surprise, Sheryl.
Right. Yeah. And FDR
did FDR approve of Eleanor's involvement, or I guess he couldn't control everything she did. And was her network, her friends, were they all involved in this too?
I mean, you know, it's usually just spoken of as sort of her, you know, pet project. FDR, it depends on different stories tell it differently, but he believed in this back to the land movement, this idea about that, you know, industrialization had brought people too far away from the land. And so he definitely supported it. And, you know, if you go back a little bit farther, it comes out of the settlement house movement. I don't think that is an accident that they have such similar names. That was, you know, it was a focus on helping the urban poor. And I think that the idea of helping people, you know, was a lot of the core of what they cared about. And
to what extent was the Resettlement Administration a kind of a legacy of the progressive populism of men like William Jennings Bryan?
Well, I guess I don't see it as connected in that way as I do to, you know, a focus more on community and this idea that the settlement house movement would have these houses where people would come and live. You know, the people, like, they offered recreation, they offered, you know, classes to help mostly the immigrant poor in the cities. And so that was more like in the 19, you know, during the progressive era. Is when it started.
So who is most, you might remind us because you know a lot more about it than I do, and certainly our audience, who was behind the settlement initiative, the settlement communities themselves?
Yeah, well, that has a whole other history. It actually started in the UK, and then it was brought to the States. It was very much woman focused here in the States. So Frances Perkins was involved. A lot of New Dealers actually came out of the settlement house movement. So Hull House in Chicago, Henry Street in New York, Eleanor Roosevelt volunteered at Rivington settlement house on the Lower East Side. And some of her biographies point to that as when FDR went and visited her there.
So let's get to the core of your book, Cheryl, A Chance to Harmonize. It's not about the Resettlement Administration. It's about the role or the way in which they sought to integrate music into these resettlements. Tell us what the thinking was behind that and the role and centrality of this very ambitious, very radical idea associated with folk music.
Absolutely. Well, it came because at the beginning, the homesteads, there was a lot of discord on them. There was a lot of, the morale was very low. People had been suffering, and here they were in this new community. You know, a lot of times it was being built around them. Their houses weren't ready. And so it was actually a conscious decision to send in music leaders to help with that morale, because it was seen as, and not just, you know, as recreation, it was really seen as core to the whole enterprise, that they needed to form this sense of community. And they felt that it actually came from the homestead directors. They said, "We need music leaders." One of my favorite quotes from a report at the time was, you know, that we need to send in music leaders to help with this emergency situation, which I love that idea.
So the music was a practical thing where people were singing together, or musicians were brought in to give musical education to these people who were being resettled?
Yeah, well, it started out as pretty open in terms of what it could be. The idea was, get adults making music together. That's going to help build the sense of community. They also offered children's lessons, which was what a lot of people, you know, kind of expected from that sort of thing. And what happened was that as the director of this music unit, they hired Charles Seeger, who is Pete Seeger's father. And he was the one who identified folk music as the music that would serve the best vehicle. You know, the idea was, here is music that is being, what is the social use of music? And he felt like folk music, music that connected to people's communities, that people, you know, that people really, it meant something to them, would then add to the idea that creating any kind of music together would help build community.
We are talking with Cheryl Kaskowitz, the author of A Chance to Harmonize, very interesting new book about how FDR's hidden music unit sought to save America from the Great Depression, one song at a time. We're going to take a short break, remind everyone that the show is brought to you by Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics. Going to run a short feature on Liberties, and then we'll be back with Cheryl Kaskowitz to talk more about this music unit and the history of folk music in 20th century America. So don't go away, anyone. We'll be back in a second.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We're speaking with Cheryl Kaskowitz, the author of A Chance to Harmonize, very interesting new book about one of the more radical music initiatives in FDR's New Deal. Cheryl, what about, you mentioned Charles Seeger, the father of Pete Seeger, who is often seen as the father of American folk music. What was the state of American folk music in the 1930s?
Well, it's a really interesting question. Charles Seeger was just coming around to it. It hadn't really been spread in the way that it would later with the folk revival. And that's why I see the story of the music unit as this kind of prequel to the story that's usually told about where the folk revival came from. And so, I mean, it usually starts with Alan Lomax and Pete Seeger, who are both basically teenagers at this time. And so you had a burgeoning interest. People talk about the 1930s as a time when there was a lot of pride building in folk, in documenting American culture. And so John Lomax, Alan Lomax's father, had been doing this kind of public folklore of collecting for several years at this point. But it was in 1934 that the first national folk festival was held by the government. And it was growing. The interest in it was growing, but it hadn't quite, it was just the beginning. Charles Seeger had originally, he came from a classically trained musical background. He was an avant-garde composer. And so earlier, he had sort of been pretty dismissive about folk music. And he started to understand it as Molly Jackson, who was an activist, union activist, came to New York. And it was this time of discovery for him and for, I think, a lot of people in the urban music world.
Sure. I mentioned having seen The Greatest Night in Pop, which featured many great African-American artists, Diana Ross, Stevie Wonder, Michael Jackson, many others. Was the folk beginnings of this folk revival, or however you want to describe it, that was triggered or invested in by the resettlement administration, was it a very white thing? I mean, was folk music at that point? I mean, African-Americans, of course, had their own very rich musical traditions. But was what you're writing about in A Chance to Harmonize, is this white folk music?
Well, it's an important question because what it does is illuminate some of the racism that was built into the New Deal, no matter what they tried, really. So these homesteads were segregated, and the music unit focused their work on the white homesteads. So there is this theme that runs through the book in terms of who is included. And the folk music that they were really focusing on was the what has become, you know, most well known, like Appalachian, it was called hillbilly music, bluegrass. So it did, it was along this color line. And what I try to show in the book is that it's very difficult to contain music within that kind of a color line. And also that, you know, it's something that we need to grapple with in terms of the history and the legacy of the New Deal.
Yeah. So obviously this was initiated by people like Rexford Tugwell, Rex the Red, leftists, progressives. And yet, as you suggest, they fell into the old racial and racist stereotypes and problems. What did African-American people, leaders, what did they think of this? And were they angry that they were excluded and their musical traditions were excluded?
Well, I'll just say that people didn't really know about it at the time. There was a lot of, you know, anger and activism around segregation starting around this time. And I will say that people, the Roosevelts and Tugwell, you know, they considered themselves to be, you know, pretty progressive in their racial views. What people point, what historians point to is the fact that the control of all these homesteads was given over to the local offices, either state or even more local. And when you're talking about the South, during this time period, it was ruled by Jim Crow segregation. So, yeah, I think that it is, what I can say in the book is that one of the collectors, whose name was Sidney Robertson, did do some of the, she collected folk music, and I can talk more about that, but part of what she did was to kind of break free, get off of the homesteads and go and capture some of the music that was happening in other communities that weren't included.
Cheryl, in it's a fascinating story, but is it a, is your story, is this a narrative, a kind of historical curiosity? Did anything really come out of the, you said that the resettlement administration and Rex the Red's involvement was relatively short-lived. What are the concrete legacies of the story in musical and in political terms, the story you tell?
Well, I think it's really interesting. Yes, the resettlement administration was started in 1935. It was folded into the Department of Agriculture in 1937, became the Farm Security Administration, and a lot of these kinds of things, while they continued, were, you know, curtailed a bit. I think that musically, what we have are the recordings. And so Sidney and some of the other music unit staffers went out and recorded folk music, and they weren't recording from musicians necessarily. They were interested in music being used. And so it is this amazing archive of the soundtrack. I think of it as sort of a sonic counterpart to the FSA photographs that have become so famous, like Dorothea Lange.
Yeah, the Dorothea Lange. If for people watching, we have her famous image of migrant mother. And of course, you write about this. A lot of these recordings are now what, in the Library of Congress?
Yeah, they're at the Library of Congress, in the American Folklife Center. And they just, the way I felt when I was writing this book, and it happened to me so often, is that I felt like I could go off and tell a deep story about so many of the things that I came across. You know, the musicians, there were union activists. She had a real interest in understanding how labor union activists used music. So she went and very confidentially recorded that music, which we can now listen to. And I did put up a selection of the recordings on my website, so that if people want to listen along while they read, they're available there. But otherwise, they can be difficult to come by. I will say, though, that a lot of them did seed the folk revival. These recordings were available to Pete Seeger, to, you know, Mike and Peggy Seeger, who went on and recorded many of them.
Woody Guthrie, did he How was he connected with this?
Yeah, so the book that Seeger and Woody Guthrie put out, what is it? Hard-hitting songs for hard-hit people, which was a lot of protest songs. They took a big chunk of those songs from the music unit, either from the recordings. Another thing that Charles Seeger did was put together song sheets to be distributed at the homesteads. And so that was a form that they seemed to just, they basically reprinted it in that book. Then that book then becomes the version of the song that people know. And so if you go back and look, you can see the fingerprints of this music unit all over the folk revival.
What about the politics of it? You noted that in 36 or 37, the resettlement administration was folded into the Department of Agriculture, which was headed, of course, by Henry Lewis Wallace at one point, at this point, who was perhaps the most progressive of all figures involved in the New Deal associated with FDR. You talked about changing or remaking American ideology. Did this experiment have any impact on how people thought about being American?
I thought about that so often when I was writing this book, especially, you know, during the COVID shutdown and all of these questions about like public good versus individual rights. It would be difficult to argue that it made an ideological difference. I will say that in general, histories of the resettlement administration sort of paint it as a failure. It didn't work. It didn't do what it was supposed to do. When you dig into some of the homesteads, you'll find people who say, you know, that their families talked about what a lifesaver it was. Johnny Cash actually was one.
So Johnny Cash, did he grow up in a resettlement administration or was he too young?
No, he was like young. He was around five when they moved there in Arkansas to Dyess Colony. And he talks openly about how his parents said that it saved them. That one was specifically for farmers whose lands had failed. And he was a little too young to be recorded by the music unit. But I love the fact that there's that connection.
Yeah, we wouldn't perhaps have Johnny Cash or his remarkable family had it not been for this initiative. The movie I talked about, Greatest Night in Pop, features a very awkward Bob Dylan, who looks very embarrassed around Stevie Wonder and Michael Jackson and Diana Ross. Of course, Dylan is very famous on lots of fronts, but particularly for his challenge to traditional folk in 1965 at the Newport Folk Festival when he went electric. How did this history that you cover in A Chance to Harmonize, how did it affect the history of folk music in the post-Second World War age, as folk became more and more central, particularly to progressives?
That's a huge question. I think that it was one of the foundations that folk revival was being built on. As I said, one of the origin stories is Pete Seeger being taken to the Asheville Folk Festival, and where he first learned the five-string banjo. That's where he got his first banjo. And the reason he was there is because Charles Seeger had a work trip there and brought him along. And so I think that it is it is just, so that's on one level. There's the recordings that fed in, and it's hard with folk, when you're talking about folk and, you know, folk culture, it's hard to trace where things actually start. But I think that you can look at these foundational things that the music unit laid, the recordings, the fact that Charles Seeger would brought Pete Seeger into proximity of these musicians because of the work that he was doing with the Resettlement Administration.
Finally, Cheryl, as America or Americans, particularly progressives, try to rethink their platforms, their way of reorganizing society, can we learn anything from this about the challenges of the 2020s? I mean, obviously, the suffering of some Americans is can't be compared to what happened in the 1930s, but there are a lot of people suffering in America today, hunger, unemployment. Can we learn anything? And in telling this story and researching it, do you think there may be an opportunity for a second chance, another way of resettling America, of remaking American ideology in the 2020s, using perhaps modern technology, different ways of doing things?
It's something I've thought about a lot. I saw that the Surgeon General declared an epidemic of loneliness and social disconnection.
No social media. I think he saw it as being caused in part by this, what he thinks as an illness of social media, a pandemic of social media.
Right. And that people have lost, you know, actual in-person social connections. I mean, I think about sometimes about the book Bowling Alone, written in 95, I think.
He's been on the show too, and we were actually talking about his book and his thinking earlier this week.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that is you know, not just not bowling alone anymore, you know, our bowling alleys have closed. So I do wonder about, if you look at that Surgeon General's initiatives to combat, and create social connection, I sometimes wonder, is there a role for music in there? And I think that idea about digital connections, needs to be further explored. Do they count in some way also?